Welcome back to Hill Country Institute Live, Exploring Christ and Culture. I'm Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and we are very pleased to welcome you to our program. The Hill Country Institute is committed to equipping and encouraging the body of Christ to engage people and culture with the heart and mind of Christ. We work through conferences, radio programs and podcasts, and online resources. To learn more about Hill Country Institute, please visit hillcountryinstitute.org. We also ask you to consider supporting the ministry of Hill Country Institute through online donations so we can continue these programs. This is Larry Linenschmidt, your host, and I'm absolutely delighted today to welcome Dr. Hugh Ross, who's here for the second half of our program. Dr. Hugh Ross is the founder of Reasons to Believe, an apologetics ministry, and he's also a scientist. And the group at Reasons to Believe does great work in preparing us to explain our faith. Their website is reasons.org, and I invite you to visit them. Dr. Hugh Ross, welcome back.
Well, thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
So glad you can be here. At the end of the last segment, we were talking about pain and suffering, and there's been a lot of ink spilled, a lot of effort spent by Christians over the years trying to explain pain and suffering, and by non-Christians. I think it's a conundrum for all of us. So we were dealing with how God, in effect, restrains evil through some physical constraints. And so how does this all add up? What does it mean when Job went through so much, and at the end, God says, well, where were you when I set the universe in place?
And well, as both a scientist and a pastor, I am persuaded every Christian needs to be prepared to deal with the question, why is there evil and suffering in the world? Of all the arguments that atheists have against the Christian faith, that's the only positive argument they have. All the rest of their arguments are basically pointing out how badly we Christians argue for our faith. But the one thing they rest their atheism on, if God exists and he's a powerful God and a loving God, then there wouldn't be any evil and suffering in the world. Mm-hmm. A good God would not put his creatures through evil and suffering. We need to be prepared to answer that question. And how I encourage Christians to be prepared to answer that question, look at the big picture. God created the universe. He created it with special physics. And if you look at the physics as we discussed in the last segment, it's fine-tuned design to restrain evil. All right, let's now look at the creation of human beings. The Bible tells us we are created in the Garden of Eden. All of humanity is descended from one man, one woman, Adam and Eve, created in the Garden of Eden, a paradisical place. God chose to allow Satan to enter paradise and to tempt Adam and Eve. And Satan was the most powerful creature that God made. There is no creature that is more powerful and wiser than Satan. Mm-hmm. Now, he lost his wisdom when he rebelled against God, but he is the most powerful of all the rebellious angels. Mm-hmm. And so what that tells me is that God saw a purpose in exposing Adam and Eve to the greatest possible evil and the greatest possible temptation. Now, God had the option to lock out Satan for all of eternity, and Adam and Eve would have never been exposed to that temptation. But God saw a purpose in exposing that. And I'm going to give you an analogy that might help you understand why God did that. I have a PhD in astronomy. That certificate that says PhD on it guarantees that never again will I have to be tested for my competency in astronomy. That's what I got from the University of Toronto. And it's based on the fact that I was exposed to the most difficult tests in astronomy and physics. And because I was exposed to that most difficult test and passed that most difficult test, it's pointless for them to test me again. So they give me a guarantee. Well, likewise, by God exposing us to Satan, we're being exposed to the most difficult tests. And if we pass that most difficult test, there is no other test that could possibly trip us up, which explains why only those who pass the test of being exposed to evil at the hand of Satan get to go to the new creation. Mm-hmm. Notice what it talks about the millennial reign when Satan is locked up for 1,000 years. children are born during the millennium. But notice what it says in Revelation. God releases Satan from his prison to test the children that are born. Nobody gets to go to heaven without being exposed to the most difficult tests. Well, let me share something else about my experience at the University of Toronto. There were 13 of us in the graduate freshman class. And I remember the professor sitting down with us on our first day and basically explained to us that we were at the University of Toronto. In terms of astronomy and physics, it was the finest institution in all of Canada. And they told us, you 13 are the cream of the crop. You're the best. However, none of you will pass and get your PhD unless you come for us for help. The program we're going to put you through is too difficult to pass without our help. And we're here to help you. We're available. Please come to us. Now, of the 13 of us, only 6 got PhDs. 7 did not. Some of those 7 failed, and some of those 7 spent time in a mental institution. It indeed was a very stressful program. And it was predominantly those who did not receive help from their professors that didn't get their PhDs. Well, likewise, God is telling us, you're no match for Satan and his demons. They're more powerful than you. If you try to pass this test in your own strength, you will fail. But I'm here to help you. And unlike my University of Toronto professors, God gives us a guarantee. If you will take my help, I guarantee you'll pass the test. But if you don't take my help, I guarantee you will fail. But I'm here to help you. Please come. I'm a loving, gracious God. I will get you through this test. And by the way, you're not going to have to suffer that much. You're only going to live 70, 80, 90 years. It's going to be a brief period of suffering, and that's going to prepare you for an eternity where evil and suffering will never exist again. Now, where I would agree with the atheists, if this universe is all there is, which is what Carl Sagan said in his Cosmos series.
Sure. Yeah, at the very beginning.
Then indeed, the evil and suffering we're going through has no purpose. It's gratuitous. And a good God wouldn't do that. A powerful God wouldn't do that. But if this universe is not all there is, if God has another realm in mind, a realm that's far superior to anything that was possible in the Garden of Eden, then evil and suffering has a purpose. Just like the suffering I went through to get my PhD degree. It wasn't easy. You know, I suffered through those 5 years. However, I enjoyed the suffering. The reason why I enjoyed the suffering, I knew what it was going to produce. And you see that in the words of the Apostle Paul. He talks about all the suffering he went through, but he also describes how his suffering in serving the Lord brought him great joy. Why? Because he knew what it was bearing in the way of fruit. And I've seen this as a professor. It's my students who've got a clear idea of what the end result of the courses they're going through is going to bring for them that perform the best. My students who don't have a clear career goal and a clear anticipation and expectation of what that career is going to do for them, they struggle. Which is why I think the Apostle Paul also exhorts us. We need to spend time, literally on a daily basis, meditating on the future reward that God has promised us. That's going to get us through the suffering of life, and it's going to turn that suffering into joy. And keep in mind what we see in the epistles. If you become a follower of Jesus Christ, you will suffer more than the unbeliever, because God's going to use that suffering to bring many people of faith in Christ. He's going to use that suffering to mature your faith. And the more your faith is matured, the greater the reward you'll be able to enjoy in the new creation.
Sure.
So in one sense, a graduate education is a good analogy for what the Christian life is all about. We have a guarantee.
So God, in the use of suffering, is on the one hand, individually, personally, building our character.
Correct.
Yeah, conforming us to the image of Christ.
Well, like I've got 2 boys that are in their 20s, and they keep saying, "Oh, Dad, can't you scientists just invent a pill that we can swallow, and we have all the education of someone who's got a doctorate?" I said, "No, part of the education is the suffering."
Yeah.
And I explained to them, you know, when I'm serving as a professor, in fact, I tell this to my students, I'm your professor. My job is to make you suffer. And please tell me if I'm making you suffer too much, because that's not going to help you. But also tell me if I'm making you suffer too little, because that's not going to help you either.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantage of what we see in the Christian faith is God measures exactly the ideal amount of suffering for every individual human being.
Yeah.
He knows what's best for each one of us. And that's why we experience suffering in different ways and at different times, because mm-hmm. we're all individual. Mm-hmm. Now, as a professor, I got to treat all my students the same.
Yeah.
But I can tell you, I know that I've got students in my class that would benefit with more suffering. But I also know there's students in my class that would be crippled if I upped up the suffering. So I kind of got to make it even. And nobody gets the ideal amount of suffering.
Yeah, sure. We're in a fallen world.
We're in a fallen world. And, you know, yeah. Unlike God, I can't devise an individual program for all my students.
Mm-hmm.
And even if I did, I would probably guess wrong.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're with Dr. Hugh Ross. We're talking about his book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, which addresses many of the questions that people ask, the why questions. Why are things the way they are? And we're just talking now about pain and suffering. But let's think about some other things. If God created a universe and God in his literally infinite wisdom could have made it any way he wanted, why do you think we see what appear to be bad design or junk DNA or issues with the human design or the design of other beings? Anything that's complex, it could be done different ways. Why do you think God has made us the way he's made us?
It tells us in Psalms and Job that the more we study the record of nature, the book of nature, the more evidence we'll see for the handiwork of God, and the more evidence we're going to see for God's attributes of grace and love, intellect, intelligence. And yes, there's been this history of looking at the world of nature and seeing all these bad designs. The problem is we scientists think the design has got to be in one direction only. I'll give you an example. The appendix was considered to be a bad design that was basically the result of evolution.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were evolved from previous species of life through common descent, and we accumulated junk as a result of that evolution, and the appendix was considered to be part of that junk. And I remember growing up many decades ago that if you had any kind of intestinal surgery, they automatically took out your appendix because they assumed it served no purpose. Here's the problem. They're only looking for digestive purpose.
Mm.
And because it was attached at the end of the intestinal tract, they assumed that if it had function, it had to be digestive. It serves no digestive function. But we now know it serves a critical role in the immune system. And so medical doctors no longer remove the appendix unless it needs to be removed because it's infected or inflamed,
mm-hmm.
because they know it's important for protecting the immune system. And if they do take out the appendix, they know they got to watch you in case your immune system gets compromised. And likewise, I can remember growing up in Canada where the doctors came by and basically lined all of us up to have our tonsils and adenoids removed. And my mother, who was a nurse, stepped in and said, "You're not going to do that to my son." I was the only one in my public school classroom that didn't have the tonsils and adenoids removed.
Mm.
Now, the rationale there was, this is another example of bad design. They don't serve any function.
Sure.
Well, today we know they do serve a function. And so doctors no longer take out the adenoids and tonsils unless they're infected or cancerous or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a matter of not being broad enough. And like with junk DNA, the assumption was, well, look at the human genome. It's 2% coding for proteins, 98% junk. That was the paradigm 40 years ago. And it was based on the belief that we're the last species to appear on Earth, and because we're the product of natural common descent evolution, we're going to accumulate the most genetic accidents with respect to time. And therefore, the human genome was anticipated to naturally have the greatest degree of junk.
Sure.
And what happened is it stultified science. You know, mm-hmm. Often I run into atheist scientists who say, claim that Christianity stultifies science. It's the other way around. It's atheism that stultifies science. Because for a 35-year period, nobody bothered to study this so-called 98% that they thought was junk DNA. And it wasn't biologists or geneticists. It was a group of physicists who said, you know, we have all this junk DNA. Let's see if we can do a computer science test on this. And basically, they were predicting that they would find far less language complexity in the junk DNA than in the coding DNA. And so this is a way that they were actually testing different software models. They were surprised to discover that the junk DNA had greater language complexity than the coding DNA. And they said, the only way that can be explained, it's got purpose. And they said, there must be more to the human genome than coding proteins. Mm-hmm. And what they discovered, for example, is a large chunk of that 98% basically controls when these proteins are brought into effect and when they're not, and actually controls the development. And the reason why we saw so much of the human genome that doesn't code for proteins, we take 25 years to develop. We have the longest juvenile development time of any species of life on the planet. And so large chunks of our genome basically act as on-off switches, saying, okay, we need to get this going now, and we need to turn it off at a later point. And that all has to be very carefully controlled in order for a fetus to develop into an adult human being.
So that quote-unquote junk DNA stays there. It's done its purpose. Maybe when the baby is a baby, and when it's 18, and when it's 20, or whatever, it's got a specific time and function.
It does.
Okay.
And that's only one thing we discovered. We now know there's about 7 different functions of DNA. And the problem was 40 years ago, they were only looking for one purpose, whether or not it codes for proteins. They were overlooking the fact that there might be multiple purposes in the DNA. And that has turned out to be a principle. Wherever we think there's a bad design is because we haven't been willing to have a big enough perspective to see that maybe there's multiple purposes involved. Mm-hmm. And so it's a powerful argument for the Christian faith in the sense that if we study the so-called bad design in enough depth, it consistently turns into a good design. And then there's another issue, too. You know, why does God create certain species that we consider to be pests?
Sure. Carnivores, parasites.
Parasites.
Yeah.
I often get that when I debate atheists. If there's a good God, why are there parasites? Mm-hmm. Well, we now realize these parasites fulfill a good purpose. So, for example, when our family celebrates Thanksgiving Day, we take some time to thank God for all the parasites that he created.
<That's>
that often makes some of our guests uncomfortable. Then I have to explain to them why, what's so beneficial about this parasite.
Yeah.
But it also needs to be dealt in the context of human sin and evil. So, for example, before human beings were brought upon the scene, mosquitoes only inhabited 10% of the landmass of the planet. Because of human abuse, they now inhabit 100%. I mean, there's a few square miles left on the planet where there aren't mosquitoes. The high plateau of Kauai is still mosquito-free. But virtually everywhere else on the planet, there are mosquitoes.
Sure.
So now we got mosquitoes in places where God never intended them to be. And indeed, that's not a good thing. But where they were originally, before we human beings abused the planet, those mosquitoes fulfilled a very good purpose. Anyone who's a fisherman knows the best time to fish in the alpine country is to fish when the mosquitoes are thick.
Yes.
Because that's what the fish are feeding on.
Sure. Match the hatch.
Right. Yeah. And what they discovered, for example, in the Canadian Arctic, the only creature that takes care of lemming poop are mosquitoes.
Mm.
If it wasn't for mosquitoes, we'd have a lemming poop problem. So...
There is a strange interconnections that
there
we don't
is.
Think about.
I mean, yeah, they there feed really the, are. There's a reason why the trout in the Arctic are 40 pounds.
Yeah.
And there's a reason why we're not overwhelmed in lemming poop.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and another aspect, same question. Why does God allow hurricanes, tornadoes, earthquakes, fires?
Well, we write about that in our books, making the point that, say, for hurricanes, we realize that a world without hurricanes would be much more damaging than a world with hurricanes. Mm-hmm. And we have on planet Earth is just the right number and intensity of hurricanes. Hurricanes, for example, act as a thermostat. They cool overheated oceans, and they cool overheated continents. They increase the rainfall. For example, Texas benefits from hurricanes and tornadoes, mm-hmm. and that they bring a lot more water to Texas than otherwise we would get. Mm-hmm. And in terms of what happens in Florida, they bring chlorophyll into the continental shelves, sure. which feeds the life that exists there on the continental shelves. Mm-hmm. So hurricanes are a benefit. Sure. Earthquakes are a benefit. If it wasn't for earthquakes, we wouldn't have any buildup of continental land masses. And eventually, the erosive forces would eliminate all the islands and continents on the planet. And earthquakes also play a role in recycling nutrients. And we realize we're living on a planet where the earthquake rate is at the ideal level. We get the ideal number and intensity of earthquakes. Not so many that we can't build cities, but not so few that nutrients don't get recycled and we don't have a balance against the erosive forces on the planet.
So the tectonic plate movement in your modeling is a part of God's design.
Well, for example, look at the United States. Mm-hmm. There are certain states that are getting smaller because of erosion. Mm-hmm. There are other states like Hawaii and Alaska that are getting bigger because of tectonics. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everything's nicely in balance.
Yeah. Well, and again, back to reminder that the why the universe is the way it is, Hugh Ross's book, that's where we're dealing with a lot of the why questions. In that book and in your own experience, what are other why questions that people might ask that you have found to be either very interesting or important in sharing your faith?
Well, one is in a book that's coming out this August called Improbable Planet. It addresses one of the why questions I address there is, if God wanted human beings, why do we have 3.8 billion years of life history that precedes us? Mm-hmm. Well, God not only wanted us human beings to live on planet Earth, he wanted us to be able to develop a large population that required that we be able to launch and sustain technology and intensive agriculture. For that to be possible, the crust of the Earth had to be enriched with about 80 quadrillion tons of biodeposits. For those 80 quadrillion tons of biodeposits to be possible, there must be billions of years of life that precedes us. Moreover, we now understand that life plays a crucial role in sustaining plate tectonics. If it wasn't for a long history of life, plate tectonics would not be sustained for 3.8 billion years. We wouldn't have the continents that we have today. We wouldn't have the mineral resources that we have today. Moreover, we now understand that because of that long history of life, we have a planet that's got 4,500 minerals in the crustal surface material. You know, before life existed on this planet, we had 250. It's thanks to life that we've gone from 250 to 4,600. Mm-hmm. And because of those 4,600, we can easily develop civilization. 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing bacterial activity transformed our planet from being poisonous to mammalian life to being safe for mammalian life. Mm-hmm. All that bacterial activity basically transformed the chemistry of the metals on the surface of the Earth from being mostly in soluble form to being mostly in insoluble form. What I share in my next book is that there are 22 elements in the periodic table that are vital poisons. Chromium is an example. Mm-hmm. Too much in your diet will kill you. Too little in your diet will also kill you. It must be at the just right level. And there's 21 other elements in the periodic table that likewise are vital poisons. Those vital poisons were all brought to the just right levels through bacteria. So yeah, when our family celebrates Thanksgiving, we thank God for 3 billion years of sulfate-reducing bacterial activity because it made the planet safe enough that we weren't in danger eating our meat and vegetables.
Sure. So you, in your view, see God's hand in all those details, the bacteria.
All those details.
The way the stars worked as a backdrop that brought just the right elements here, the carbon level
is
just so.
Also made me appreciate nothing is wasted. Mm-hmm. Every life form that God has created over the past 3.8 billion years serves a role in making it possible for billions of us human beings to be redeemed and enter the new creation. So the fungus, the bacteria, all those billions of years, the biodeposits, the transformation of the chemistry, it's all there so that God can redeem a huge number of human beings.
We have much to be thankful for.
We do.
So in closing, if someone in our audience is trying to think about how to share my faith with someone who's a scientist or scientifically oriented, how would you approach that? You know, a non-scientist trying to relate to a scientist, how do I start a conversation about faith that I can be comfortable in?
Well, you need to ask questions. And by the way, it's not just scientists. Mm-hmm. The majority of the American population, they're not scientists, but they admire science.
Mm-hmm.
And so often what you're dealing with, they'll say, hey, I read that this was discovered. It doesn't seem to fit the Christian faith. Can you help me with this?
Sure.
And you say, well, I'll try. Tell me what it is. And if you're not able, you can say, you know what, let me get you a resource.
Mm-hmm.
For example, what I've discovered in our Reasons to Believe constituency, a lot of people basically get our books and DVDs and give them to their non-Christian friends.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would say to people, you can't answer people's questions, we got resources for you.
At least you can give them a book.
At least you can give them a book
DVD.
Or a DVD. Give
mm-hmm.
them something.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I would encourage you, you need to read the book as well.
Mm-hmm.
Because that will give you an opportunity to say, you know, how about we get together for lunch and talk about what you just read?
Sure.
That enables you to build a relationship. And moreover, I think it's effective if you allow the scientist or the science geek to teach you. It's like, you know, I was reading this stuff. Can you help me understand this?
Yeah.
It's a great way to share your faith. You know, get them to help you understand the argument, and they'll, by osmosis, understand it themselves.
Well, and one of the things that you write about is humility, and when you're explaining something, or humility when someone else is testing your ideas. And so for us to be humble in the eyes of the world and ask
questions. Very important point.
Yeah.
People listen much more clearly to your demeanor than they do your words and your arguments.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really crucial. It says that in 1 Peter 3:15.
Yeah.
Always be ready to give good reasons for the hope within you, with gentleness, respect, and a clear conscience.
Yeah.
And that's what's going to draw people to be willing to listen to your reasons.
There was something special about Christ. Jesus had a winsome way about him. He was invited to dinners by people that weren't his followers. There must have been
right.
something that got people to wonder, what is it about this person?
Well, we're to emulate that.
Yeah. Well, Hugh Ross, founder of Reasons to Believe, thank you for being with us today.
It's been my great. Pleasure.
Thank you very much. Thank you for joining us for Hill Country Institute Live. We invite you to visit our website for podcasts of the radio programs, along with videos of speakers at our past conferences, including Andy Crouch, Hugh Ross, Alistair McGrath, Eugene Peterson, Dallas Willard, and more. Your donations also help this program and ministry to continue. You can donate through our website, hillcountryinstitute.org, or you can call us at 512-680-7993. That's 512-680-7993 and hillcountryinstitute.org. Thank you again for being with us.